the tensions really are around how am I supposed to live my the creed, if you like, that I the oath that I want to honour about being present to the patient and providing the best of everything for the patient, putting the patient first, with my own needs. And I think this tension between, it's very, very clear that when the doctor is well, well supported, feels valued, feels seen and heard, that they deliver, they have the best capacity to deliver the best medicine. We know that patient health outcomes and patient experience is much better when the doctor feels well and feels well valued, feels seen and heard.
Are you a health professional wanting to explore all the options life has to offer? Then you've come to the right place. The Balanced Medics Handover podcast is all about living outside the box of what we've been told. I'm Isabella, your host, a junior doctor from Australia and trained coach. I'll be interviewing health professionals from all walks of life, artists, authors, non-clinical specialists, and more. These stories show that our choices are endless. Let's take the journey together. This is The Handover. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Handover. This episode, we have Cherie Johnson on. Cherie is a registered psychologist and executive coach to leaders, business owners, and health professionals. Cherie is the founder of Coaching for Doctors and the author of the best-selling book, The Thriving Doctor. As part of Coaching for Doctors, Cherie also offers Recalibrate, an immersive development program for doctors. And the fact that well doctors are better doctors and help patients achieve better healthcare outcomes is the underpinning of a lot of what Cherie works for and is something that Balanced Medics wholeheartedly believes in and also advocates for. So it's really great to have Cherie on to share her wisdom. Without further ado, let's hand over to Cherie. Hey, Cherie, how are you?
Hi, Isabella. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to see you.
Yeah, lovely to see you too. It's great to have you here and to share your many, many years of working with doctors in this space. I start most episodes quite similarly. Can you share your journey and how you got to where you are now?
So I'll try and give you the short version. Obviously, yes. It's been quite a long career by now. So I went to university, studied behavioral science, and then became a psychologist. And it was when I came out of my four-year degree, I was entering into the recession we had to have. So it was really hard to get a job, actually. It was really difficult. And I ended up working in child protection, which was literally the job that I could get. So I didn't really ever envisage as a training psychologist that I would be working in child protection, but I'm very grateful for that now. It was an incredibly steep learning curve, a very complex system to be working in, and really has given me an amazing grounding for the rest of my working life. So my early years were working in welfare. I managed a team of about 20-something people working in youth and family services for quite a long time. I ran the Vic Roads EAP program for a while, did lots of different things, and then had my children and opened my own counselling practice. So whilst I was running the counselling practice, the therapy, I was also training to be a coach and really interested, probably since I was at uni, very interested in the world of work for people, the impact of work. Probably if I had my time again, I would train to be an organisational psychologist, but I've kind of got this far along without that, that's probably not going to happen in this life, shall we say. So just had this natural curiosity always about the impact of work on people's life and what work gave and took away from people's health. Whilst I was running the therapeutic practice, I was also learning to be a coach and doing a lot of that work in corporate spaces, and developed a really strong interest in the impact of mindfulness. So, and that came about, I think we'll talk about that in a bit, but that came about because of a health crisis in our family where I really moved from mindfulness being a sort of curiosity or a casual dalliance to making that really core in our family and in the work that I was doing with people. And so just over time, really, the coaching practice became bigger. The health experiences really brought doctors into my frame in terms of their experience and their behaviour. I was very curious about the variability between the doctors that we were meeting, and just felt like all of my skills in meditation, mindfulness, counselling, coaching could be useful to the doctors that we were meeting. So I started to say that to just cold on the internet that I coach doctors. And the practice grew until I closed my counselling practice because there were so many doctors looking to understand what coaching was and to understand whether coaching might help them in their work and in their life.
Wow, it's really interesting to hear the organic growth and just following your interests. And, you know, you wouldn't expect to be where you are now from where you started. What drew you to psychology?
It's a hard question to answer. When I was at school, I had law, speech therapy, and psychology in my sights. I actually went to start the speech therapy course, and within about 3 days, said I'm in the wrong place. So I guess I just had a very innate curiosity about people. I am fascinated by how we do the things we do, why we do the things we do, how blind we can be to our own behaviour. How difficult it is to give and receive feedback and to have a desire, a want to grow, and also a resistance to that, a fear about that. So I don't really know in any kind of concise way except to say that I've always been interested in people. I'm more extroverted than I am introverted. So I like hanging out with people. I'm curious to understand why we do the things we do. And I think that the research more and more is showing that this connection, this ability to hold relationship and be in relationship is in fact the best indicator for our happiness. So as a young person, I'm not sure, I'm sure I didn't know that. I just wanted to do a job that was with people.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you talk about relationship as well and the importance of being in relationship with people, because it's so true how much it affects how we live our lives. And now you mentioned a bit as well about how you got into coaching for doctors, but now in the past however many years, you've been specifically focused on doctors. What led to this focus?
So for people who have read my book or know about our work at Coaching for Doctors, they probably do know that my husband Tim died of cancer in 2011. So that cancer journey with him was a four-year journey. It was completely out of the box. He was 37 when he was diagnosed. We had three little kids. It was certainly not what we were planning for our lives. And we found ourselves in many different hospitals. We engaged lots of different complementary therapists as well through those 4 years, and really were quite kind of startled by the different kinds of care we had and the impact of that. So some of the doctors we worked with at that time, I would describe in my experience, were terrible. Now I understand that there was probably many other things going on that I really, as a member of the public, had no notion and no understanding of. I have a very different view of what those doctors might have been doing or not doing than I had at the time. But at the time, when a doctor was not doing a good job in terms of engaging with us or joining us in a partnership, we felt very angry, we felt confused, and we spent a lot of time and energy trying to understand, you know, what just happened and how are we going to get the information we need, and really debriefing and trying to process what felt like poor relationships. And then we were working with other doctors and other health professionals who we had excellent, warm working relationships with, and we felt like that really added to Tim's capacity to heal and to our family's current level of stress or well-being. So it just became very clear to me that the relationships that we were having with our health professionals were either enhancing our capacity to be well or to manage this difficult situation we were in with Tim having a terminal diagnosis, and or the opposite. They were taking away energy that we didn't have to give to anything else except for managing what we were managing. So as I said, I have a much more compassionate view than I had then, but in the stress and the tension and the distress that we were in at the time, the one thing I could tell was that the relationship with the health professional was important for Tim's health and for my health, in fact.
Yeah, and it's amazing that you could have the compassion for those doctors now, and that you were curious as to why they were acting the way they were acting, even through such a difficult time.
I think that other quality that you point to is important, that the curiosity that I, you know, I do have a very natural, probably gets in my way sometimes, but a very natural curiosity of, you know, what's happening here? Why is this happening?
Yeah, not just accepting it for what it is, but going beyond that. Now, you have extensive experience coaching doctors. What are some of the most pressing challenges you've noticed that doctors are facing right now?
Well, I certainly will answer the question, but I do want to preface it with I want to be careful about kind of stereotyping or lumping everybody in one big basket, because of course there are many different kinds of ways of being a doctor, you know, some are patient facing, some are not, so I think that the tensions are tensions that probably all adults experience sometimes. Doctors experience them perhaps more often because they're putting themselves in very complex system in the face of human suffering, and they're doing that, you know, on a very regular basis. So the tensions really are around, how am I supposed to live my the creed, if you like, that I the oath that I want to honour about being present to the patient and providing the best of everything for the patient, putting the patient first, with my own needs. And I think this tension between, it's very, very clear that when the doctor is well supported, feels valued, feels seen and heard, that they have the best capacity to deliver the best medicine. We know that patient health outcomes and patient experience is much better when the doctor feels well and feels well valued, feels seen and heard. So I think the research is clear. I think most of us can accept that. The challenge is in that question of how. Well, how do I meet the overwhelming number of patients, the triple booked clinic, the timeline demands, the financial pressures of children at school and mortgages and so on that adults in the middle of their lives generally experience. So it's kind of, it's a nice theory, but how am I actually going to deliver that? And because doctors have very high expectations of themselves, they have to have met all the hurdles that they've met to be practicing medics in the world, and they've been raised up generally as with high expectations at school, academically, there are habits that are hard to break. So habits and expectations about delivering and delivering at a high level, and knowing that that's in some contexts and in our complex health system impossible. There is no systemic facility to allow perfect or best practice a lot of the time. So I think that's a real hurdle, because doctors have been practicing this habit, if you want to call it that, their whole lives, and often have come out of families that practice that kind of culture, and then come into medical school and a medical culture that's also endorsing and supporting stoicism, perfectionism, high achieving, optimal care, these kind of big words, big ideals that, you know, we all want. You know, as a patient, I come into the healthcare system wanting you as the doctor to give me your best of everything, your best knowledge, your best wisdom, your best skills, your best attention. So our whole community is really complicit in this attitude of, give me the best of everything you've got. And it's just unrealistic for human beings. So I think that's the biggest, most consistent challenge that we all face in medicine, and I include myself in that. I'm sitting with people with this complexity. And we're not talking about linear problem solving. We're talking about complex systems that are nested inside other systems, that really are puzzles, predicaments, paradoxes, more than solving a linear problem. Many of the doctors that arrive at coaching arrive saying, I should be able to solve this problem. I'm a good problem solver. And so they are arriving essentially in an identity crisis. So this crisis between what's my role and what's myself, and how can these two things live together?
Yeah, it's like you said, it's a very complex system. It's complex challenges, and you're right. A lot of doctors go in with high expectations of themselves and of their performance. To get this far, you know, you need to be a high achieving person, and that perfectionism is definitely something that a lot of doctors experience, and it's a system that is far from perfect. So trying to deliver those results in a lifetime of those habits is very hard to change, isn't it?
I think that plays out in, you know, work-life balance. Half of the people who come to coaching, that's the problem they arrive with, that I need some help with my work-life balance. There is a gender difference. Sometimes again, to be wary of stereotypes, but women will come and say, I've got a work-life balance issue. Men will say that too, but men sometimes describe it as, I need some help with my time management, or some more kind of management language, I guess. I don't have any research about that. That's just what we see in our client group.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that anecdotal, what you've seen. I'm particularly interested in female physicians, because I think now we are becoming more of the majority in graduates, in medical students. And I think there's the research proven that females physicians are more likely to suicide or think about suicide, which is different to the general population as well, that men are more likely in the general population. So it's interesting that it's kind of flipped in medicine. And I feel like there's actually not much research as to why that is at the moment. And hopefully more research will go into that and the maybe different pressures that females face. I'm not sure, but that's just something that I'm interested in, that I don't think we really have the answer of yet. I wanted to ask you if you've noticed any recurring themes. I think you've touched on some, but any recurring themes in the doctors that you coach?
Well, certainly, as I've said, the work-life balance, the pressure issue about the tension between my needs and the patient's needs. Pardon me. I think there's more and more diversity in the way doctors are working. So there's some new themes emerging post not really finished with the pandemic, but as the pandemic progresses, around, you know, how else could I practice medicine? So before I used to often be in conversation with doctors about their transferable skills, and there was a sort of that's not a real thing kind of view that, well, yes, I can see how you, the non-doctor, me, could describe these things as applicable to other places, but I really can't imagine myself doing anything with these medical skills except medicine. Whereas now I think there's a much more open-minded kind of appetite for that. There are, and it may be that there are generation differences in that. I can't say that yet, and I'm not aware of any research that's clear about that. But I think that there are more doctors now willing to think about, how could I do some medicine a couple of days a week and something else in the other days of the week? Certainly the system is having to change to respond to that, or more doctors wanting to work part-time. That may be also due to gender, perhaps. And certainly there are differences across different countries about travelling doctors. So working as locum has a different flavour about it now as well than I would say it had before the pandemic got going. So I think there was some perception around you locum because you can't get on a training program, or you locum because you've got some problem in conflict where you're working. Whereas now I think locuming for a portion of doctors is actually a very attractive option in terms of lifestyle. So I think that's different. And then we do a lot of work around leadership. So a lot of work around doctors thinking that they might have got on the wrong training program, thinking that they want to be the director of their department, or feeling the pressure in terms of succession to be the next director of the department, and not being sure if they want to do that in terms of lifestyle or expertise. And I think the other group is around just communication. So lots of doctors coming around, either there's been a conflict or they don't feel assertive and confident enough to speak, bring their own voice to the table. So those kinds of issues as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's really interesting your first point about how things, perceptions of medicine are changing, that doctors are, instead of the all or nothing approach to who is a good doctor, you can be a part-time doctor and still be a good doctor. Locuming doesn't mean, I think before locuming was more of a dirty word and had a bit of a stigma to it, but now it's very common. I think majority of people at PGY3 are taking a locum year. It's actually very, very common. And it'll be interesting to watch the space and how that changes and hopefully workforces can respond to that.
Yeah, that would be really exciting, Isabella.
Yes.
When we think about development, PGY3, PGY4, I mean, what are the peers of these young people doing, you know, in other industries? And many, many of them are taking a gap year, are traveling, are doing lots of other things. And medicine has been difficult. It hasn't allowed or facilitated young people to do that kind of thing. It has so much value for young adults to be out in the world experimenting and experiencing. It brings so much value when they came back. You know, I did that as a young person, as a 23 and 24-year-old, went off traveling, came back to my state government job after a year. I'm still living off the value that brought my life.
Yeah, 100%. It's opening up your view and eyes to the world and other ideas, which can benefit hugely medicine, especially when it's generally more of a conservative system, you know, injecting new ideas.
Yeah, and not only for the doctor themselves, but for their all of their relationships, including their colleagues at work when they come back to medicine, and their patients and their patients' families. You know, this lived experience has extraordinary value.
Yes, and hopefully this time for yourself and time for other things can prevent and protect from burnout as well, which is at an all-time high right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you emphasize mindfulness and reflective thinking in your practice. What common mindset or behavioral patterns have you observed that tend to limit doctors and fully, you know, experiencing the best well-being that they can have and their growth?
So a lot of people hear mindfulness and start to close their ears and eyes. So just encourage the listeners to hang in there for a couple of minutes with us. Mindfulness is really not about some sort of panacea. It's not about rosy-colored glasses. It's about having the resources and the skills, the practice, the mental muscle, if you like, to stay with whatever's here. And it's an incredibly powerful tool for self-regulation and also for choice. So if we're able to notice what's happening, you know, oh, I've got this knot in my stomach, or oh, I want to get out of here, or I notice my mind is saying, oh, not another person with this same old shit. But if we can notice that in real time, in the moment, then we have an opportunity to choose how we respond. And it's literally a heartbeat, like one pause, one moment, to be able to just feel our feet on the floor, take a breath, and choose how we want to act. And people who are able to do this kind of regulation in real time build their emotional intelligence. They have so much more skill at managing their own emotions, at regulating their own thinking, and also of reading the room and understanding the other people more accurately. I think that medicine is incredibly reactive. It depends, of course, on your specialty, but there are lots and lots of parts of medicine that are incredibly reactive, and certainly people in their junior years in hospital and people at department and unit level head kind of positions are really in crisis firefighting mode most of the time. And so they are living off adrenaline, cortisol, they are permanently in fight flight, and it's incredibly hard to make wise decisions. And we're expecting that they will. You know, they're dealing with life and death situations, they're responding to multiple things at a time, they're responding to environmental noise and activity and distraction. And we expect in the middle of all of that that they will continue for 8, 10, 12, 15 hours to make wise decisions. I think that, you know, to be frank, we're crazy. To get this skill of being able to pause and notice what's happening in our own body or in the environment or in our mind and make a wise decision requires practice. We can't be in the heat of the moment in fight, flight, fully activated for a stressful situation and suddenly think of a thing that we've never practiced. These gentle practices all the time, like twice a day, noticing your feet and feeling your feet on the floor. Doesn't matter if you're walking or sitting or standing. You can be in theatre. You can be behind the desk in clinic. You can be in a meeting. It doesn't really matter where you are. You just notice your feet and really feel the floor, feel the connection to the ground twice a day. Every time you do that, you're activating your networks in your brain, your neurological pathways for presence. And to be mindful, we need to be present. We need to be in this moment, noticing what's happening right now in this moment, so that we can then choose what the next moment and the next moment holds.
That's so important, the presence, the mindfulness. And I think you're right, we are crazy to expect doctors to function at such a level with all the competing demands. And, you know, often as a doctor, in my experience and from those around me, you get very good at suppressing all or not just how you're feeling and not just your body and your emotions, but, you know, your hunger, your needing to go to the bathroom, feeling dehydrated, all these things. You kind of just a mind on top of a body that just carries you around the hospital.
I often say to people, we're more than a head on a stick.
Exactly. And personally, I know I'm sometimes functioning as a head on a stick, which it's a big thing to break, right? To get change that way of acting, and especially when you've spent your whole life in that.
Totally. Yeah. That mindset. I feel like it's important here to just say that we're talking about both and, you know, it's fair to say exactly as you point to that the only way I can operate is as you're describing, because the system is asking me to see so many people and to not pause and pay attention. And so we need to be real that we are talking about we need system change, we need system acknowledgement, and we need individual skill. And it's my view that we can't change systems without individual skill. So I can't actually observe what's happening in the system if I'm so distracted and caught up and on autopilot and crisis, lurching from crisis to crisis. I don't actually have any capacity in that state to observe the system and make comment about how we could improve the system. And for the system to be really effective, it needs my comment because I'm one of the ones in the system. Yes. So we have to talk individual skill and system issues together, both and. It's not ever going to We're never going to get where we'd like to get with either or. So I think that this thing about practicing small things, one breath as I get out of my car, one breath as I get in my car at the end of the day, feeling my feet once or twice a day, you know, taking one long slow exhalation when I do go to the toilet, making a commitment or a decision that I will not let myself be dehydrated because I can't make good decisions when I'm dehydrated. So what's one small habitual change I can make? I'm going to bring a different kind of bottle, or I'm going to make sure when I go to the toilet I do also drink the equivalent of a glass of water. Whatever of those small things, and there's hundreds more of those if possible, that we're doing every day when we're not under stress, at home, at work, everywhere, so that when we are then in crisis, we've got already these habituated processes that help us pause and say, hang on a minute, what's happening? I just need to take a breath here before I make this decision.
Yeah, big time. And you're right, it is, you know, it is a system issue, but individuals change systems. So it's a yes and, it's a you know, we're all in it together and we are part of that change. I'm curious, what's your view? Because I think also a lot of the time you're focused on the next goalpost in medicine, you know, medical school internship, residency, training program, consultancy, which can also get you out of the present moment. Mm. How do you approach that kind of mindset with your clients?
Mm. Well, again, another moment of tension, isn't it?
Yes.
But, you know, this is the reality. And how can I still honor my life?
Yes.
My personhood, my relationships, whilst I'm making this choice to live in this reality. And so you can hear in some of that language, the coaching kind of language, what's the reality? I had a meditation teacher who would say, if you fight with reality, you will lose, which I love, you know. So I chose to be a doctor. I'm here willingly. I want to meet the next hurdle. I want to move into residency. What do I need in order to do that? And with every problem, I think we need to look at three things, essentially. We need to look at the cognition, so the thinking about it. What am I telling? What story am I telling myself? Nobody's making me. I don't have to. I choose to. I get to. I want to. So what's happening in our thinking that's useful and not useful? And we all have limitations in our thinking, and it's really hard to see our own limitations, which is part of the value of a coach or a trusted friend or whoever you have these kind of conversations with, that they can point this out. And I would say, as a sidebar, doctors generally are not well trained at giving and receiving feedback. And so I think that we could have a whole other conversation about that. So the cognition, what am I saying and thinking to myself about it? The emotional response, what's happening in my body? What actually am I ignoring, suppressing, distracting from? What can I honor and own up to? What can I be curious about in my body that might actually help me? You know, my own body actually can tell me a whole lot of stuff that's useful. Yes. If I am able to tune into it. And our culture in Australia, at least, and so many other Western cultures, really has helped us turn away from our body rather than helping us really tap into that as a resource. And the third one is the community around us, the support network. We are social animals. We are not designed to do anything on our own. Medicine actually asks you to do lots and lots of things on your own. And so how can we, and I think medicine is improving. I think the colleges do some terrific work around setting up peer structures for people when they're coming up to OSCEs for practice and those sorts of things. But I think there's a lot of things we can advance beyond where we are. That's about asking for help, essentially, or that's about collaboration. And medicine to date hasn't done a good job, I don't think, as an outsider, in helping people really build the skills of collaboration and partnership and asking for help. And in truth, actually, adults don't really like asking for help. That's not special for doctors. That's most adults. We're all pretty bad at it in Western cultures, at least, because we think of asking for help as some sort of weakness or some kind of demonstration that we're not up to, you know, whatever we're supposed to be able to do. I think actually it's a missed opportunity. And if we could shift our language, our understanding of what that is, we have the opportunity for, you know, amazing connection, relationship, community. Those are the things that actually make us, help us thrive.
Yeah, asking for help is huge. I think, it was one of the biggest learning curves for myself as well, realizing that medicine is a team. Sport's not the right word, but it's a team. Mm. Not just all on the doctor's shoulders. And the moment you start seeing it as a team and asking everyone around you to be involved, you realize how much the load can come off your shoulders. And then, yes, the narrative you tell yourself, you know, I have to do this, I have to do that. It's like, actually, no, it's a choice that you're making. And then connecting with your body, it's quite interesting for people, in my experience with coaching as well, is spending just time being like, what do you notice? What sensations? And it's very foreign for some people, but you start to notice things, you know, your tightness in your neck or in your chest or whatever it may be. And it really starts to open things up for you.
Yeah. Even things like noticing where your energy is. So, talking with a person in coaching about a problem, they can be very flat. They can be very upbeat. They can be, you know, leaning into the camera and getting very excited. They can lean back and crossing their arms. You know, all this body language is giving us information about what's important, what matters. And when we can tune into our own, you know, where do I feel energized? What's uplifting for me? What's really deflating for me?
Yeah.
Then we start to have access to a whole lot more opportunity and possibility. And I think that that's really the best case scenario in coaching, where we're not looking so much at the limitations and the restrictions and the problems and that sort of linear path, that we're actually looking at the possibilities and the evolutions and the opportunities and the, you know, what could happen, what might happen if I could describe this differently, if I could get out of my own way, if I could imagine myself standing in 2 years down the track. And, you know, there are lots of great metaphors for this, you know. Sometimes I talk about it. So now you're hanging onto the edge of the windowsill on the outside of the building with your fingernails. You know, what do you need? You know, to have some conversation. You know, well, I need a harness. I could probably hang up here all day if I had a harness. Okay, well, how are you going to get a harness? Where are you going to get one from? Because you're hanging on the windowsill with your fingernails. You know, well, I could shout out to someone down below, or I could shout in the window, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Or thinking about being on a mountain, you know, you go mountain climbing, you get to what you think is the peak. You get to the peak and you say, oh, I've made it. And you realize that it's just a little plateau and there's a whole other big uphill to go up again. So, you know, coaching allows us to help the person be in these places and see through metaphor, or see through other descriptions, get some other perspectives, get up on the balcony, look across at the mountain, the other mountain across there, and start to open up our thinking. It's my favorite definition of coaching, which is to think differently.
Yeah, and I think another big thing for doctors is the way you ask questions in coaching, because in medicine we ask questions to narrow down and to get the diagnosis, and coaching is the opposite. It's opening up, and it's a real way to shift your mind, and it's quite empowering and exciting to start to open things up.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully said. You're reminding me of a coaching session where a person said to me, this is quite Socratic. You know, it was a bit of a reminder to me that I'd kind of got hooked up in the problem solving with the person rather than opening up the thing. And it's a very human experience in coaching, particularly with an experienced coach who can notice that kind of stuff happening and shift and change where they are, which we, like doctors, get as we have more experience, this co-creation of the conversation that goes on in coaching.
Yes, the co-creation. Now, your book, The Thriving Doctor, is a great read. I think everyone who hasn't read it already should have a look. And it has some really practical tips, which I think is what doctors and maybe adults, you know, working adults love as well. How do I actually do this? So could you share one strategy that you think's resonated the most with your readers and clients from your book?
Yeah, it's hard to pick one. I found this actually difficult to think of one. But maybe it says more about me than the doctors, but I really love all the little language hacks. They're immediately applicable. They can transform a person's situation with kind of one word or one sentence. So things like, instead of saying but, say and. Take but out of your language altogether, say and. The classic coaching one, which I'm sure you're aware of, which is ask, don't tell. Now, for some circumstances at work in medicine, you won't want to adopt that one. But, offering try and instead of but, and try could instead of should, and try experiment instead of, I'm stuck with this. Try, you know, could I run an experiment? What would that look like? And another great one is energy and time. So oftentimes people will come to coaching and they'll say, I need to organize my time better, or I don't know how to manage my time, or I need to be able to fit more things in. And so being able to say, well, let's stop thinking about time. Let's talk about energy. You know, where do you want to put your energy? Energy is a renewable resource if we're clever about how we use it. Time is not. And so thinking about how can I shift from thinking about time being time driven to energy. And the last one in terms of words would be, I think I said it already, should and could. So doctors come loaded with shoulds. I should be able to do, 100 things at once. So being able to say could actually invites us into this world of choice.
Yes.
And as we've talked already, the train track of medicine gives you very limited choice. It narrows, as you describe with diagnosing, but also as you're choosing which training program to go on, which specialty to go in, which hospital to work in, which subspecialty to work in. You know, it's a track that somebody's laying it out in front of you and saying, well, this is the next thing you should do. And so I think it's easy for doctors to forget that actually I can step off or slow down. You know, there's this momentum, this drive to keep going on the train track. And actually, in any given moment, you can say could instead of should. You still might make the same decision, but at least in that moment, you can have some feeling of relief, some opening up, some other possibilities.
The power of choice, the power of being in charge of what you do. And you're right, there's a lot of shoulds in medicine, and it's really fun to be curious about where's that coming from. Why do I feel like I should be doing this? And I think I just want to remind all the listeners that only a certain few people of the world have a medical degree.
Yes.
And that there's a whole other world out there. I think it's like 0.001% of the world. I don't know. I did the calculations the other day. It was very small.
Yeah, but it's also a great reminder of the value that you have. You know, that yes. Doctors come and they say, oh, you know, I couldn't do anything else, or I'm not good for anything else. Or, you know, the rest of the population holds you in great esteem and really needs and wants your skills.
Yes.
And so we need to actually remember that, to value ourselves and collectively to be valuing our doctors, not in some kind of special precious kind of way, but just to recognize that if you were in a corporate space and you had a particular set of skills that 0.001% of the population had, you could name your price. And so, you know, really holding these two ends of the seesaw, holding some perspective and some balance about service and the gift and the giving and being a contributor to community, and also that I've worked really hard for these skills that I have and I want to value them and I want other people to value the work that I've put in to get here. I'll just say one other thing about that autonomy is an incredibly important basic psychological need for adults, that we have autonomy in our lives. And I think that's one of the big struggles for doctors, trying to find where can I have autonomy. I don't know what the Australian number is, but 73% of doctors in America are employees. And so when you are an employee, as opposed to, say, a GP or a family physician in their own private clinic, that has its own struggles, of course, but it's quite different in terms of autonomy. And so we sometimes need to be a little bit more creative or experimental, expansive about how we can feel that autonomy in our own lives, which is important for adult development.
Yeah, I love that, getting creative with how we can bring autonomy into our lives and seeing where it can be possible, and experimenting, like you were saying, experimenting with that. Now I could chat all day. It's so exciting to chat about this, but I'm mindful of the time. Oh, I should change my language there. And I'm mindful of the time.
Yes. Well done.
Yeah. So looking ahead, how do you see the future of medicine evolving, or maybe what are your hopes, and how will coaching play a role?
Such a big question. We could spend the whole hour together on this question.
Yes.
I think that, you know, I said before that if we fight with reality, we'll lose. There are many, many things in the environment and in the world that we are not in control of, that we need to work out how to respond to and work with rather than try and manage or control. And I think the AI stuff is in that category. We are going to see, and we are already seeing, this incredible pace of development with AI. We've seen it since the internet, really, and probably before that, in terms of just the increasingly rapid pace that these things are developing. So I think it's useful for us to accept that that is the reality that we live in, and to be having many more conversations about how we can work in that reality together. We have very significant workforce shortages. The most critical one probably across the world is nursing in health. There are many things that doctors can't do without the appropriate nursing support, and there are many things that nurses can do beyond what they're allowed to do in many settings in health.
Yes.
So I think we really need to, again, bring our creativity, our compassion, our openness, our curiosity to how we work in teams, and you spoke beautifully about that earlier. and what the roles are for people in teams. One of the very big risk factors for burnout is lack of role clarity. And so I think that as we go through this fast-paced changing environment where, you know, we saw in COVID where people were being redeployed all across the health system to do things that they weren't usually doing, that they hadn't done for years, and getting this very short, sharp kind of upskill or reskilling, I think we may or may not see more pandemics, but we're going to have this rapid pace with people changing roles, moving in and out of teams that are very fluid. I think our ability to collaborate and understand what makes a good team function really effectively on the fly is going to be important for us. There's some doctors in emergency departments are already working in this way often, and so that we have the skills and the knowledge and the wisdom collectively, but we might need to find some new ways about how to share that. There's an interesting term in the coaching world called flocking, which I'm only just starting to learn about, and I think it has, and there's not much research, it's early days for this concept, but the idea is that a well-functioning team is able to share its energy and the things it's learning with the teams around it, and that we're able to leverage the system much more quickly by teams sharing or departments or people sharing what they're learning side by side in a more rapid kind of way. And coaching is happening much more in teams as we go forward than it is individually. So I think there's some things there that I'm certainly not in any way expert to speak about at this stage, but I think there's some very interesting capacity for teams. You might have, for instance, two or three coaches in a room with a team full of people. The team might be a very fluid team that three coaches are working with over a long period of time. You know, I think that there's really exciting things like that for coaching coming, and not so far away. We're in conversation with many heads of department, and that number's growing pretty rapidly. So I think there's a lot of interest. There are questions around funding and what that all looks like, and it is experimental. And so definitely if there are any listeners who want to talk with me about that, please bring your curious experimental self. Don't come looking for a recipe. But I think there's a lot of scope for this. In terms of individual coaching, because we're as adults coping with fast pace, confused identity in terms of role, high risk situations in terms of burnout, I think there's lots and lots of ways that coaches can help doctors. As we've discussed already, I've gone from doing many other things to just working with doctors. We have a growing number of coaches in our group. There are many doctors looking for support and help, and who are finding it in coaching. So I think that that's an integral part of going forward. I'm clearly biased, but I have,
me too.
I have the privilege every single day of seeing the benefits. So I just am lucky to do what I do.
Yeah, I love that. And it is exciting to see the change and the transdisciplinary part of it. So getting everyone and their knowledge involved and sharing that knowledge. Mm-hmm. Now, you also offer Recalibrate. So mm-hmm. it's due to start very soon. Can you share more about this and who would benefit?
Yeah, thank you. So Recalibrate's our immersion program, as you said at the beginning. It's a hybrid coaching program. So all the people in Recalibrate have 6 coaching sessions with me, and then we have peer masterclasses, the equivalent of 24 hours. So depending on whether you're doing it face-to-face in the room together or whether you're online, the way that is delivered varies, but the curriculum's the same. And so we're in small closed peer groups working on compassion, mindfulness, communication, deeply embodied listening, how to prevent burnout, how these skills enhance our leadership, those kinds of things. So it's personal development work that has a huge impact on professional skills and professional capacity. The next program, as you said, the next face-to-face program, we've been delivering, this is our 7th year, so it's very exciting. We're getting quite a community of doctors out in the world now who are recalibrators or who have recalibrated with us. So the next program starts in Melbourne face-to-face on the 8th of March. It probably feels like a stretch for anybody to get into there with their rosters and their schedule and their kids at sport and so on. But I really want to encourage you. We are happy today to offer the early bird rate, which is long closed, but for any listener who wants to contact me in the next week or so, and join us for the face-to-face program in Melbourne, please say that you heard me talking with Isabella on the podcast, and we'll offer you the early bird rate. It's four Fridays in Melbourne for the masterclasses, and then the coaching as fits into your schedule online. And then the second one for this year starts in April online, so people can go on our website, coachingfordoctors.net.au, and see all the details for the online April program. We've had lots of doctors from New Zealand and Australia. We've had even a doctor from the US in the program. So it's 100% of the graduates endorse the program, say they would love their colleagues to do it, that it should be compulsory. It's the most rewarding, impactful, powerful thing that I'm engaged in. I love it so much, and I would really be happy to welcome any doctors that want to come. We do have a few places in the online program, and we've had some doctors have to change because of their shifts and family stuff. So we do also have a couple of places in the Melbourne live program. So please do get on it if you want to come.
Yeah, what an opportunity for anyone listening that you can also make use of the early bird code. So that's really lovely. And then just wanted to know, can you also claim that as CPD now that we have to self?
Yes, you can.
CPD.
You can claim it as CPD. If you're a hospital doctor, most people can claim it through CME, although the junior doctors don't have such a straight pathway there. So we do have one scholarship per program. It hasn't been used at this stage in either of those two that I mentioned. So if you're a junior doctor and you would like to come, please message me and ask me about the scholarship. We only have one per program, but that's a saving of $4,000. It's half price.
That's so great. So there's a scholarship available. It's CPD claimable, which is great now that we all have to do the reporting of CPD.
Yes.
I have a second last question. What is balance to you? I ask this of everyone as well that comes on.
Well, I love the seesaw metaphor. It's all over my book. And I think that balance is essentially that I can move a little bit this way, I move a little bit that way on my seesaw and keep it. I don't think it's a rigid thing. I think it's more, you know, this kind of thing. It's that would be balance to me rather than something like that. But essentially it's homeostasis. You know, our bodies are actually experts at balance if we give them the right fuel, the right raw material, if we're available to notice the messages that we're getting from our body. So for me, balance is really about just homeostasis. It can be different over time. I might have this week, I've had a really focused week at work. No kids here. I've got three university age children. They've all gone away. It's been great to just really zero in and focus. But of course, I've missed them. And the last 3 or 4 weeks while they've been around, I haven't worked as much because they've been coming and going and we've been doing things together. So I tend to look at balance as with a wider lens. If today is really hard and hectic, that's okay because probably next week there'll be a day that's a bit lighter. There are some things for me to keep in balance that I need to do. You know that I'm a proponent for mindfulness, so sometimes it's formal mindful meditation practice. Other times it's long, slow walk and being present in the walk. And I have a very good walking habit. I walk every single day and I make sure that I see my friends as much as I can, which sometimes is more, sometimes is less, but I think these are all really critical. And no processed food, Isabella, as much as I can.
All good on you.
Hard, really hard when you're traveling, but, you know, keep working on that one.
Yeah, that is a hard one that I enjoy partaking in. Now, yes. Is there anything else you'd like to add that you think would benefit the listeners?
Oh, just really the most important thing I want to add is thank you for the work that you do. I think that we do lose our perspective when we hang around only with doctors. It happens to me too. If I see lots of doctors lots of days in a row, we forget that what you're doing is generally really hard. And as you said, most of the population doesn't put themselves in this position of sitting with suffering, dealing with complex problems over and over again, where you don't have control for so many of the elements of what's happening. You know, medicine is an emerging science. That means that what we know today isn't necessarily right tomorrow because that's the nature of science. And so I just really want to encourage everybody to think about, you know, how you describe what you do, to hold some wide lens perspective as well as that narrow perspective that you're so well trained to get down to, that, you know, what you're doing is difficult, complex, and even though the patients and their families often look angry and frustrated, they don't know. I didn't understand. Really underneath, they value you very deeply. We can't run a successful well health system without the doctors, the nurses, the allied health, the porters, the security, all of the people in health.
Yes.
And I think it's a community-wide conversation we're really engaging in. I know we're very focused here on doctors, but I think that a lot of my work is advocating for doctors in other places to remind people that it's a collaboration. And the more effective we all can get at our partnership skills and our communication skills, I think that the healthier we can be.
Yeah, the ripple effects of having the healthier doctors for the community as a whole. Yeah,
totally.
How can people reach out to you, get coached by you, sign up to recalibrate?
Yep. So coachingfordoctors.net.au is our website. You can see me and Coaching for Doctors on LinkedIn. We're on Instagram. We are on Facebook, but we don't really like it, so we don't do very much on Facebook. In terms of coaching, the easiest way is to get onto the website and click the links and book a conversation with people. Our other coaches all have some availability at the beginning of the year because lots of people finish at the end of the calendar year. So we do have some spaces at the moment. We don't always. So if this is something that sounds useful and interesting to you, the best thing to do is book a time with one of our coaches, and then you'll find out if it's going to suit you or not. We'll tell you. If it's not, if we don't think we can help you, we'll tell you.
Yeah, that's important. Finding the person that you click with and finding the right resource as well for the time, the context and time you're in.
Yeah. And for those people who can't afford the coaching, you know, have a look at my book. Thank you very much for giving it a plug.
Yeah.
I wrote The Thriving Doctor because of that reality that we want to get these ideas out as wide as we possibly can. And not everybody can come to coaching. Not everybody is going to need a coach all of the time. But, you know, find those really good resources like The Thriving Doctor. Get on Isabella's podcast, listen to all the wise voices on there, and don't be alone.
Yes, I love that. I'll put all of those links in the show notes below. Thank you so much, Cherie, for coming on. It's been so great to chat.
Absolute delight. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Balance Medics Handover podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, I'd love for you to take a minute to rate and review this podcast and click the follow button. For more resources, check out the Balance Medics website. The link to this will be in the show notes below. See you next episode.